This is anti-aging psychologist Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net. Today's show is Life Lessons from Literature with guest Dr. Joe Sperry. I confess, I'm fictionally illiterate. I feast on nonfiction books but haven't read a novel in decades. At my Toastmasters meeting, Dr. Joe Sperry, a former English literature professor, gives these marvelous speeches about his love of great literature. Dr. Sperry says he reads more than 150 novels a year, plus stacks of nonfiction books, and I thought, maybe fiction has something to teach us about how to age well. I couldn't let that rock go unturned, so I challenged Dr. Sperry to come up with several books that had positive images of elders or had something to teach us about aging. And happily, he rose to the challenge and will share the results today. Warning: entering Dr. Sperry's web of passionate bibliophiledom may impel you to rush to a library or a bookstore and get an armful of books. Consider yourself warned. Joe, I'm delighted to have you with us.
Thanks, Mike.
I gather that finding 10 or so books on aging that created positive images or had life lessons wasn't an easy task.
Well, I mean, I found several bibliographies that are strictly novels on aging.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are highly negative. Bad broken marriages, people dying and horrible diseases, yes. So it was a challenge to come up with, I think we came up finally with 6 or 7 positive ones. On the other hand, the positive ones are very, very strong.
Why do you think there was a preponderance of negative images?
I guess what I would think is that the people who are writing novels about old people are not themselves old.
Hmm.
So they probably don't see anything positive about it.
Well, aren't there quite a few novelists who lived to a ripe old age and kept writing?
Yeah, there are a few, but the one I'm thinking of right now is somebody I had to take off the bibliography, Patrick White, who won the Nobel Prize from Australia, wrote a whole bunch of books at the end of his life about aging. Unfortunately, there wasn't one positive one, which may say more about Patrick White than it does anything else.
Hmm. Let's jump right into your favorite book, which was All Passion Spent.
Yes.
Could you give us maybe a 2-minute synopsis of this?
Yeah. What you have is Lady Slane, who is the now widow of a former British prime minister. She's looking around and she has to decide what she wants to do with the rest of her life, which isn't long, but her children would like her to spend time with them and continue to do charity work. And she says, no, not in your life. What I'm going to do is I'm going to buy a house in Hampstead and I'm going to garden for the rest of my life. And what she ends up doing is realizing how much she gave up by being in that particular marriage, and she blossoms as the artist she never had an opportunity to become in her last few years.
You lent me the DVD of this, so I got to get a feel of it even without reading it. Reminded me a lot of Upstairs, Downstairs,
yes.
the British type of theater. What were the lessons that you got from All Passion Spent?
Well, I think it would be too easy to say, don't give up on your dream. But I think that's what she's getting at. Because if you really look at that marriage, she liked the marriage, she liked her children, she loved her husband. But in order to do that, she basically had to give up on who she was and what her dream was. And it really isn't until her last 3 years that one of her friends, who actually had known her decades before, points out that she is, in fact, an artist and would have been a great artist had her head turned in those directions or had she not gotten married.
Part of this was the role of women, namely to support their husband. But is part of this what life is like with the aristocracy?
Oh, yes. Yes, because, you know, as you say, I said he's a former British prime minister, and they were very, very wealthy people. So, yes, it's what life was like in the aristocracy. And when we're talking about Edwardian, probably 1915, 1920, basically there were proto-feminists. I think the author, Vita Sackville-West, was a proto-feminist. But in the Edwardian time, a wife married to a famous man really didn't have much opportunity to do her own thing. I mean, she was too busy holding parties, doing charity work, and taking care of the children.
I look at this, and to me, the family was almost like Dallas, you know, the movie series, where everybody is entwined in your life and expecting you to fulfill roles that if you were a more middle class or lower class person, you wouldn't have nearly the family pressures. You would just have the normal family obligations, and once your children were grown, maybe those would loosen up.
Well, I'm not sure you can. The lower levels would have their own problems because they don't have any money and they don't have any power. But yes, yeah, I mean, she didn't have a choice, really. I mean, she could have had a choice, but then she wouldn't have been married. She might have been a great artist, but she wanted to have a family, and she did have a family at some cost to herself.
So one of her lessons is it's never too late.
Right. And I think that's the most positive thing about the book. I mean, what you have is there's a great scene. Some of her children are absolutely awful, and some of them are very, very wonderful. But there's a scene where all the children get together, and they were all saying, "What shall we do with Mother?" And they pretty much parceled out what she was going to do for the rest of her life now that Father was dead. And basically she had her own plans and lived her own life very richly for the last 3 years that she was able to live. I mean, she's in her mid-80s when this happened.
Well, actually, that's kinder than the contemporary counterpart where the kids get together and decide what nursing home to put you in.
Oh, as a matter of fact, let me get the title for that other book that fits in here. The Autobiography of an Elderly Woman. This is one that I knew nothing about, by a woman named Mary Heaton Vorse, that was published in 1911. It purports to be the autobiography of an elderly woman, but in fact, Mary Heaton Vorse, who was in her 30s, wrote this in the voice of her mother. And what you have there is her children are very, very overprotective, and she bridles under the fact that she's been an independent woman for so long, and now she's still 18 in her head, but her children are treating her as if she were a fragile flower, and she doesn't like that.
So how does she handle that?
She establishes really good relationships with her grandchildren. So in that way, it sort of comes full circle. And she does establish relationships with one or two of her children. She has a bachelor son who's kind of an arrogant jerk who she's able to counsel in relationships. He's just blown away by how much she knows. Shouldn't be, I suppose. She's been around for a long time. So she found some allies among the children, but found more friends among the grandchildren.
Interesting parallel in that in All Passion Spent, it's the granddaughter who has the great relationship with our main character.
Actually, if you look, I'm pretty sure it's the great-granddaughter.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, but yes, the great-granddaughter finds herself in a very similar situation. She's been given a proposal of marriage to an aristocratic guy, I don't know, he may even be titled, but she's wrestling with the fact, should I do this and give up my own dreams, I think she is an artist as well, or should I marry him? Or should I go my own way and be the artist? And she, at the very end of the book, she decides not to marry him and to live her dream.
Right. I think she went to music school.
Yes.
There were some other interesting issues in All Passion Spent. One was the attitude toward younger people, which I hadn't seen anywhere else.
When they're talking about how tiring it is to be with younger people?
Exactly.
There's a section here that I love. This is Lady Slane, who is ruminating, and what she said, they were too old, all three of them, to feel keenly, to compete and circumvent and score. They must fall back to the old measures of the minuet, in which the gentleman's bow expressed all his appreciative gallantry towards women, and the lady's fan raised a breeze insufficient to flutter her hair. That was old age, when people knew everything so well that they could no longer afford to express it save in symbols. Those days were gone, when feeling burst its bounds and poured hot from the foundry, when the heart seemed likely to split with complex and contradictory desires. Now there was nothing left but a landscape in monochrome, the features identical, but all the colors gone from them, and nothing but a gesture left in place of speech. Which I think is one amazing paragraph.
Yes, I mean, it's elegant in the way they communicate, and yet it's so conserving of energy, and as the phrase was, monochrome. But we end up with this almost condescending attitude toward younger people of how tiring and dull they are.
I think tiring is the key issue.
And I thought about that, and the way I took it was that there are some people who have this view, and it's a very legitimate view, but it's probably a small minority. Most older people that I talk to, the great-grandchildren are the love of their life. So I concluded that it's good to identify different options, not that this is the option that people ought to choose.
Yes. One of the things I've seen is you get very different kinds of grandparents. I mean, we have six grandchildren, and we adore them, and we spoil them. But I know people who are our age who have grandchildren who refuse even to go over and sit for them. What they say is they're just kind of nurtured out. But, you know, that's just who you are.
My mother, I mean, I expected her to have a tremendous influence in her grandkids, and both her and my dad, when he was alive, mild interest, but they tired of them very quickly. It was just too much commotion, too much energy for them.
I've been going through a second parenthood because one of my grandsons lives with us. We have custody. And all I can tell you is the period between when we adopted him and when the other kids had grown up and gone away was a time where we were, for the first times in our lives, able to move to our own rhythms. And some people don't want to go beyond that. And I can understand it.
Mm-hmm. When we look at All Passion Spent, what did you make of her relationship with men her age?
What she did was, it was very funny because the people that she established relationships with were, in one case, the landlord of the house that she bought, an unforgettable man named Mr. Bucktrout, and then I can't remember the name of the guy who fixed up the house, and then Fitzgeorge, who was an art collector who had known her early on when she was in her 20s in India. And, you know, the section I read about being with people her own age, men, was primarily like doing a minuet where everything was done in symbols. Very kind, very good listening. They have all the time in the world. They're not hustling and bustling. They concentrate on the relationships. Her family is scandalized by the fact that she's having relationships with lower-level people, but she doesn't see it that way at all. She finds them excellent company.
She seemed to mesmerize these gentlemen. What was her appeal to them?
Well, and I see this. I loaned you the Masterpiece Theater, the DVD, because I think it's my favorite Masterpiece Theater. I think what they see in her is someone who is absolutely upfront and honest about who she is and what she likes, because they point out that the world seems to them, younger people, webs of deceit. Gasheron, that's the name of the guy who fixed up her house. They see what a special person she is. And Fitzgeorge even sees and remembers her in her 20s as being a talented artist. He's finally the one who gets her to admit what she gave up by getting married to Lord Sling.
And this is what I hear from an awful lot of people in their 80s and 90s, is I don't have time for that nonsense. They just cut right to the chase. And while I think when you see people, you know, say a centenarian on Jay Leno or something, they're just so refreshing in that they just pop out with these remarks that are so candid.
She's very candid, but she's also a lady, which they appreciate. So it isn't so much as blurting with candor as much as it is an appreciation for who she is, and they all understand how special each other is. They see that almost intuitively. There's a wonderful section, the last three or four pages of the book. Mr. Gasheron is hand making her coffin, and they're looking down at Lady Slane, who is lying there on the bed. They need to put her in the coffin. And Gasheron makes the comment that she's in repose, and people who have lived a kind life tend to be more reposeful, more clear about who they are, and you can see it in their face. And while they're making this comment, her daughter is there hump, and you know, doesn't want these people to do it, wants somebody else to take care of the coffin, wants somebody else to take care of the funeral. And both Mr. Gaucheron and Mr. Bucktrout are looking at the daughter and are not saying anything, but they're clearly comparing the repose on her face with the worry and anxiety on the face of the daughter. It's a wonderful ending to a wonderful book.
That conflict reminds me of, in Jewish tradition, it's a great honor to volunteer to take care of the dead body and prepare the dead body, as opposed to something you would relegate to somebody else, because that would be too impersonal. That word repose was so key in that. What did you take repose to mean?
I would say the repose in this case is a matter of being comfortable with who you are. Now, she was comfortable in her role as wife and mother, but she had an opportunity to be something quite different, to go back to who she had been before. Didn't have much time, but she knew that that's the way she wanted to go. And as I say, in her last 3 years, she became sort of the artist. She's a kind of an artist with her friends. I mean, she appreciates the beauty that's there. And Mr. Fitzgeorge, who has millions of dollars worth of art that he ultimately wills to Lady Slane, she appreciates the art greatly, but she doesn't appreciate it because it creates more problems. She doesn't want that level of responsibility, and she ends up giving it to the, I think it's the British Museum. Now, I don't know what Fitzgeorge would think about that, but she did not want to have to worry about that. She wanted to be who she was, and that goes back to the idea of repose.
And the contemporary counterpart of that would probably be downsizing to a small condo or retirement community where you don't have to worry about all the maintenance and driving and all that stuff.
Well, in fact, I mean, she had people who took care of her, the guy who fixed her house, and Mr. Bucktrout. One of the more hilarious scenes in the movie is where Mr. Bucktrout and Lady Slane supposedly negotiate the price for what they pay, because Mr. Bucktrout really wants her to live there. Lady Slane really wants to live there, but she wants to make sure that Mr. Bucktrout gets a fair profit. So what they end up doing in the negotiation is talking each other down. So she ends up, I'm sure, with what is a very, very fair price, and Mr. Bucktrout is pleased because not only does she live there, but it's clear that she would welcome him as a friend and as part of their society. Limited, but very rich.
So her appeal was candor and class, and there's something about somebody who really knows who they are and doesn't need people that's very appealing.
Yes. I mean, she would speak of a person being of integrity, and she was very much of integrity. She was of integrity when she was a wife and mother, and now she was of integrity when she moved beyond being a wife and mother.
Oh, I like that word. Let's move on to Memory of Old Jack. Could you give us a short synopsis of that?
Well, what you have is 93-year-old Jack Beecham, who's a farmer in Port William, Kentucky. This is his last day alive. And he looks back. He was born during the Civil War. He actually remembers the Civil War. And I think this takes place in the early 50s, if I'm not mistaken, because he's 93. And as he looks back, his sense of time, well, he'll see someone and think it's their grandfather, or he'll recognize, as he says, a nose and know the uncle of the person who had that exact same nose. He looks back on his marriage, his blighted marriage, on relationships that he had with people, and look back primarily on the work that he did. Wendell Berry is, I think, one of the most interesting American authors because he has a philosophy, a worldview that's based on love, the land, community, and hard work. And so when I was teaching, I taught his novels, I taught his poetry, I taught his essays, all of which are of a part, all of which reinforce each other.
The lesson for us from Memory of Old Jack is...
Oh, you're asking me?
Yes.
Okay. The lesson from Memory of Old Jack. Well, I think the primary thing is, this is an Edith Wharton quote, but she said, do your job and hug your friends. To boil it down as simply as possible. Mm-hmm. Jack was a farmer who worked bone-breakingly hard for 15, 20 hours a day for, 70 years. Still does a full day's work in his 90s. He's a little slow these days, and you can see it by, he goes back in time. The book is a series of wonderful flashbacks and then flash forwards again to here he is. He's the person who's thinking these things, but he's the person who was also a part of all those flashbacks. The memory of old Jack, it's his memory, but it's also his community's memories of him. And in that way, he's a much, much richer character.
So we see memories from multiple perspectives, both the community and his own, and in different periods of time.
Yes.
That's fascinating. He also had a cold marriage. It kind of reminded me of the Crucible. How did he handle that?
Well, I'm just looking at this paragraph, which I'll read here in a second. He fell in with the wrong woman, or he fell in love with the wrong woman, and I'll try to, this is a little long, but Jack did not exactly occupy a vacancy. He usurped the place of some well-educated young minister or lawyer or doctor whose face and name were perhaps not yet known to the mother and daughter, but whose places had nevertheless been appointed. She is an upper-class woman, and he is a farmer. Jack was not a man who could be much dreamed upon. He lived too close to the ground for that. The illusions and false hopes of their courtship could not survive the intimacy of their marriage, and in failure of their courtship, their marriage failed. From the ignorant pleasures of her maidenhood, she was transformed on her bridal night to the martyrdom of sexual sainthood. That was as far as it went. This was as far as it was going to go, though he would be years giving up. He was her cross, and she bore him with a submission that afterwards chilled him to the bone. They lay beside each other in solitude, as rigid and open-eyed as effigies. And there's this chilling a paragraph about a marriage as you're ever going to read.
I'm just curious, what life lesson did you gather from that?
Well, speaking as someone who's been married twice, I got it after the first marriage.
Okay.
Yes, I was moved by parts other than my brain in my first marriage, and in the second marriage, I was moved clearly by an appreciation for who the other person was. And I think Jack has a bad marriage, and he really, really works at it, but finally he gives up. There's just nothing he can do to please her, and there's nothing she can do to please him. As a matter of fact, one of the parts of the book that I think is most moving, he has an affair with a doctor's widow. And finally, he meets someone who is of the same ilk as he is, hardworking, close to the ground, a warm and passionate person. And he has, I think, a 4 or 5 year relationship. She unfortunately ends up dying in a fire, but for those 4 or 5 years, they each blossomed under each other, so to speak.
Was this a physical relationship?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was more than a physical relationship, but with Rose, Jack finally had a place to put his passion, and Rose had a place to put her passion. It was a powerful, very moving relationship.
So how did this very ethical man handle an affair?
Well, he really suffered. He really suffered. There are several times, the wife, Ruth, catches him, and she knows he's going to visit Rose, and she says, "Where are you going?" She asked in such a way that he knew she knew. For a moment, the question angered him. "You've made that none of your business, my girl," he thought, and then he sensed the pain in her that the stance and look of her defied, and he grieved for her. He saw that his infidelity had touched her as his love had not, that she who could not abide his passion now helplessly and deeply bore his wound. It turned her toward him, revealed her to him, too late, and for no mercy or denial that was in his power, that beautiful woman with her gray eyes, so fine. And he said with a gentleness that she had not stirred in his voice for a long time, "I'm going to look at a red calf with a white brush on its tail." And he said, "You look fine this evening, Ruth."
Wow.
Yes. Barry will, you're reading along, and all of a sudden you'll come across a paragraph like that, and there are a lot of them in Barry, and especially this book. This was his second novel. He's written five or six now and a couple of novellas, all about Port William, Kentucky. And this one I have read, I know, five or six times. It bears repeated rereadings.
We're talking with Dr. Joe Sperry, who is himself a fascinating person. Not only is he a former literature professor, but Joe, you also have a passion for rescuing animals, a passion for stalking wildflowers in the hinterlands, and by day you're a business consultant with S4 Consulting. And also a wonderful speaker, and you often have a sense of humor that reminds me very much of Lewis Black.
Well, I hope I'm not as profane as Lewis Black.
I didn't say profane, but I did see him live, and it was very disappointing live and very foul live. I think he does better on television.
Well, he does better on television because he's constrained in his language. He's a very sharp wit who, when given his head, unfortunately seems to have to rely on profanity, which I don't find witty, and in very few cases do I find it humorous.
And all the books that we're talking about, I will put on my website, agelesslifestyles.com, so you don't have to worry about rushing to write them down. We'll get back to Dr. Sperry in a moment, but first a word about speaking services. Note how old you feel now, you will soon feel a lot younger after hearing Dr. Bricky. That's how I'm usually introduced when I give a keynote address. We are brainwashed with limiting beliefs about aging. As America's preeminent anti-aging psychologist, I bring good news for a change. A change in how you view aging, and I do it with a good helping of humor. In short, I help audiences learn the mental game for living longer, healthier, and happier. But I'm not satisfied with people just acquiring information and having a feel-good time. I have people adopt healthier beliefs on the spot and lock them in for lifelong benefits. I also like to stay and do breakout sessions, consulting, and individual coaching at no additional cost. When your organization or business needs a speaker, have them check out my demo video at anti-aging-speaker.com. That's anti-aging-speaker.com. And give me a call. My phone number is on all my websites. And now back to Dr. Sperry. So let's get back to some of your favorite books. One of them was Memories of Hadrian. What is that about?
Yeah. Well, Memoirs of Hadrian purports to be a long letter that the Roman emperor, second century Roman emperor Hadrian, is writing to Marcus Aurelius. And it's written by a French woman named Marguerite Yourcenar. She worked on it for over 30 years. And all I can tell you is, when you read this book, it's the memoirs of this Roman emperor, and beautifully, beautifully realized. This is a book, Barry has great paragraphs, Yourcenar has great sentences, and this is the story of a deeply flawed but magnificent man who does wonderful things for the Roman Empire and yet can be as petty as anyone, and usually recognizes that he's being petty. I like the book now because he's exactly my age as he's writing it. And he looks back on his life, sees the good things, sees the bad things, and tries to draw out the lessons so Marcus Aurelius will hopefully avoid his mistakes.
It sounds like the interviews with David Frost and Richard Nixon.
Well, in fact, you have to read it. There's no way I can finally describe it. But this is a book that I read at least every 4 years. Because I read it first when I was in college, and I thought, yeah, that's pretty good. But the older I've gotten, the more I respect the point of view. It's like Mark Twain talking about how much more knowledgeable his father had become between his ages of 17 and 21.
So what kind of lessons do we get from Memoirs of Hadrian?
First get the lesson that people are very complex, because here is a man who's known, for example, for building Hadrian's Wall in England and basically bringing peace to the world that the Romans owned by going in and settling foreign lands and not acting as dictators, but working with the kings and the people in those foreign lands to have peace. As far as I know is the only time a Roman ruler had universal peace in the lands of Rome. He also pulled back from some settlements where he couldn't do that. But what it meant was, because the tribes and all the other countries were on the side of the Romans, they acted as a buffer between the wild barbarians that he did not have a relationship with. It worked out very well for everyone. Mm. That would be one lesson.
Mm-hmm.
The other lesson is you can love too much. Part of Hadrian is a, I want to say, a 200-page love story with a fellow he falls in love with and has a long relationship with. And it's pretty clear that a lot of the pettiness comes from this particular relationship. So you have a great man who is at the same time very, very petty, very, very complex, very, very interesting, and just as rich a human as you're likely to come across.
Was the love relationship homosexual then?
Yes. Yeah, Antinous was a, I can't remember where, what his country was, but yes, he was, they met, I think, in some foreign country, Greece, if I remember correctly, and they had a, 15-year relationship.
Another book that you really liked was just titled Age?
Well, that's the one, Mike, that I've tried to order three times.
Oh, okay.
And I did never get hold of it. I like Muriel Spark, who wrote that particular book, and I love the description of the book, but I had, as I say, I wasn't able to get my hands on it. Yes, I would certainly recommend it based on Muriel Spark's reputation and what the other books that I've read from her, but I haven't. I mean, what seemed interesting about that book is it's two very literate people in their 70s who decide to keep journals of their own life. In other words, the husband is writing about his life,
mm-hmm.
and you know, vis-a-vis the wife, and the wife is writing about her life. And apparently the journals are very, very, they switch back and forth, but apparently the journals are very, very interesting. And finally, as they get older, they decide that they would much rather keep the journal together because there was a richness in both of them writing together. And it just seemed to me like that description of a book makes me want to go out and get it. And God knows I've been trying.
Oh, I think it's just a fascinating premise,
yes.
and you have the all these different levels of how are their journals different when they do it individually versus when they see each other's journals and when they combine the journals, and just a fascinating premise.
These are apparently very well-read, very intellectual, very intelligent people, and the journals, from what every review I was able to find said that it's as rich a writing as you're going to come across, which, of course, maybe you want to get it all the more.
Mm.
No, I'll read it. It's on its way, supposedly. I'm hoping it'll come through this time, but definitely I'll read it.
Another one that you liked was Spence plus Lila.
Yes.
Can you tell us about this?
Well, Spence plus Lila. Bobby Ann Mason, who wrote that book, is from Appalachia herself, and she writes about the people of Appalachia. And you'd think of them as relatively unsophisticated, but Bobby Ann Mason shows that they're as sophisticated as anyone, and particularly in their relationships. You have a case where Spence and Lila have been married for 40 years, and they discover that Lila has breast cancer. And so Spence doesn't really like coming to the hospital, but he does to support Lila. And you see him in wonderful internal monologues trying to get around the idea that he might lose Lila. And Lila, in wonderful monologues, interior monologues, says she's not sure that Spence can go on without her. And, of course, neither is Spence. So what you mm-hmm. get, you start off with what seems to be a very traditional, very basic sort of family, and it becomes a rich, rich exploration of a mature marriage.
Wonderful. Any other books that you've come across so far?
Well, I came across a bunch of books, but if we're concentrating on positive images, I think those mm-hmm. are perhaps the images that are most positive. Now, God knows you could get into all kinds of stuff, but, you know, something like King Lear is not exactly a positive portrait. I mean,
mm-hmm.
he's magnificent, but it's a tragedy, after all.
My bias is that we have so much negative images,
oh, yeah.
especially on television, you know, it's just so much crime and war and that kind of thing, that we need more balance of some positive images yes. and positive messages.
I would agree that authors, and especially writers on TV, do not really have an appreciation for the wisdom, the counsel of the old. I mean, when was the last TV program, aside from the All Passion Spent, which was a British production anyway, that you saw on TV an older person who was not the butt of jokes or cruel humor or someone that you could really, really respect. And they just don't know how to deal with that. They know how to deal with sarcastic marriages and relationships, but they don't really have an appreciation for, a feeling for what age can bring.
I think there has been some. The Waltons had that feel to it.
Yes, okay. You got me there in the 70s.
Bill Cosby, maybe he's not quite old enough to be grandfather, but I think we had three generations on that program. And you've had a few families where you had that, and then you had some programs where the character wasn't exactly a role model, but still was a fascinating character and not negative. I'm thinking of the HBO series 6 Feet Under,
okay,
where the older mother struggled with her role in the family and did find a boyfriend and married him. And
well, that mother is certainly worthy of our respect in some ways, but she also, talk about a rich character, is mm-hmm. about as flawed as you can be, and both her relationships with her children and relationships with the people that she decides to take up with.
Mm-hmm. And then in movies, we do have some movies, you know, say Driving Miss Daisy.
Yeah.
Well, and even TV, we had Golden Girls. Granted, it was a sitcom, but it still had some of the characters had some.
Oh, man. I don't think what Golden Girls was about is to show that old people could make smart-ass remarks as easily as younger people. I mean, I didn't see the respect for age. I didn't see the wisdom of age. It was basically a sitcom, and the people just happened to be old.
Joe, you're right. I take it back. Well, it's been great fun, and I love your choices, and you've certainly whet my appetite for literature, and thank you so much, Joe.
Good. Well, I hope you read something.
I'm sure I will. You already got me to listen to the DVD version of All Passion Spent.
Well, as a matter of fact, I'll recommend that again. That's the best masterpiece theater I ever saw. The best taking of a novel and putting it into dramatic presentation. It's just, you don't find them any better than that. I waited 20 years for WGBH to finally come out with it, and they finally did, and I grabbed it in a second.
Well, again, thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.
Commentary. What can we say about life lessons from literature? The good news is that there are some wonderful books with role models for aging well and insights into paths and viewpoints that we might choose as we age. Dr. Sperry flagged 6 of them for us. I'll post them on my website, agelesslifestyles.com, but to give them to you quickly, we had All Passion Spent by Vita Sackville-West, The Memory of Old Jack by Wendell Berry, Memoirs of Hadrian by Marguerite Yourcenar, Age by Hortense Kalischer, Autobiography of an Elderly Woman by Mary Heaton Vorse, and Spence plus Lilla, that's L-I-L-A, by Bobby Ann Mason. By the way, that's a 1998 paperback. Amazon didn't know what to do with the plus sign, so they made it Spence and Lilla. If you aren't likely to read a novel, I note that All Passion Spent is also available on DVD. One role model we missed was Miss Marple in the Agatha Christie novels. By the way, when we drifted on to television shows, I didn't think of one of the best portrayals of an elder, Murder, She Wrote, in which Jessica Fletcher, portrayed by Angela Lansbury, is a very self-sufficient retired English teacher who both writes mystery novels and is an amateur detective who solves a real murder every week. Despite her fame as a writer, she chooses to live a modest life in Cabot Cove, Maine, and have close friendships with longtime friends instead of letting success go to her head. That show, whose main character was loosely based on Miss Marple, ran for 12 seasons plus 4 TV films. Of course, I advise never to live in Cabot Cove. The murder rate there is atrocious. Well, the bad news is that Joe had a really tough time finding the six novels he came up with. Why? As he put it in a note to me, it's as if people reach a certain age and just disappear, trundled off to a nursing home or perhaps used as actors in incontinence prevention ads. TV shows generally make mothers of teenage children look 20 and their mothers look 40. Everyone looks great in bikinis and everyone has sex. Can you picture a TV show called All Passion Spent? Think of pitching a television movie about an 87-year-old woman whose 94-year-old husband has just died. I would suggest one reason for the dearth of literature about elders and aging, besides the movies and television's obsession with sex, violence, and youth, is that life expectancy in 1900 was only 47 years in the U.S. Thus, until the last few generations, relatively speaking, there weren't many people who had lived past 70 to write about it. While it's certainly possible for younger people to write about older people, we see this, for example, in Tuesdays with Maury, a memoir in which the author visits his professor who was dying of ALS and shares what he learned about life, death, and dying. Most of literature about dealing with aging, however, is likely to come from people who have experienced it personally. Perhaps we'll see an avalanche of baby boomers writing about aging and positive role models as they themselves age. In movies, for example, we see Clint Eastwood's more recent movies providing fascinating insights into coping with aging. Perhaps baby boomer authors and producers will follow in his footsteps. Emails. I love getting those emails. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. That's radio@agelesslifestyles.com. I'd especially love to hear your comments on Dr. Sperry's recommendation or suggestions you have for literature or even movies and TV programs that portray positive role models for aging well and help us learn how to deal with aging and what kind of lifestyles we can choose for aging well. Emails in the show last week with Dr. Helen Harkness focused on how delightful and refreshing she is. As one listener put it, anyone who starts the interview with a philosophy of live long and die fast captures my imagination. A reminder for information on anti-aging psychology, my books, my hypnosis CDs, my free Defy Aging newsletter, and my speaking services, you can go to either drbricky.com, that's drbricky.com, or the portal site, notaging.com, notaging.com. Remember, I'd love to get your feedback. Send them to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. If you've ever been in a nursing home or visited a nursing home and wish there were an alternative, be sure to catch the show next week when author Beth Baker talks about alternatives to nursing homes, not just theories, but dozens of real-life alternatives that, compared to most nursing homes, look like paradise. So be sure to catch Beth Baker next week on alternatives to nursing homes. Till then, this is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, on Ageless Lifestyles Radio on webtalkradio.net. Thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.